Welcome to Making Sense of MarTech, a podcast about, well, you guessed it, making sense of MarTech. I'm your host, Juan Mendoza. I'm the CEO of the MarTech Weekly, and a weekly email that covers the most important shifts in the marketing technology industry. So today, we have a very interesting guest. Her name is Corey Munchback. She is the CEO of Blueconic, a leading customer data platform. In this episode, we talk about Corey's journey to becoming the CEO of the company that's growing and scaling in the CDP space and right in the middle of one of the hottest categories in the MarTech industry. And so now I give you Corey. How you doing?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
So I have been fascinated by your story because you've worked at Blueconic for a long while now. We were actually, just before we hit record, we were talking about your amazing blue parka that you got years and years and years ago. And it's a bit of a, you know, trophy for the legacy of time that you spent at Blueconic, really helping to build and scale the CDP there. But I guess I want to talk about, you've shifted into the CEO seat fairly recently. And I can imagine that's been quite a shift from working in the business under leadership and then now kind of working as a leadership. But I want to start with, I guess, your story, and perhaps we can use a day in the life to tell that. Now, I want you to pick a recent day. It can be any day. It doesn't matter which day it is. Maybe a Monday to Friday day, not a weekend day. And I want you to walk me through what it looks like to be the CEO of a marketing technology company. So do you have a day in mind?
I do. I'm ready.
Ooh. Are you ready? Okay. So what is that day? Is it two weeks ago? A week ago?
Yeah, it was last week. I'm going to go with a day last week. I think it was Tuesday. Honestly, I can't exactly remember, but let's go with a Tuesday of last week.
Tuesday of last week. All right. So day in the life. How'd you start your day?
Yeah. So all my days, Monday through Friday, typically start the same if I'm not traveling. I am a bit of a creature of habit and have a routine. I know you're shocked to hear that someone who's a CEO is a creature of habit, but I have a routine that really works well for me. I get up in the morning. I usually batch out kind of emails and just sort of catch up on the news while I'm waking up. I do the Wordle and I do the connections puzzle from the New York Times. That is how my morning starts every single day. I do a headline scroll of the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the information, those kind of places that are important just to give me some context. I get up, I exercise in my basement. I am a devoted fan of Peloton and make no apologies about it. Usually I walk my dog if I need to, or my husband does. Sometimes we do it together. And then I kind of get my day going, and it starts from there. I try to journal every morning too, for about 20 to 25 minutes. I admit that some days that falls off, but I try very religiously as much as I can. And then I get right into it, right? So most of my day starts somewhere around 8:30 or 9, sometimes a little earlier. We've got a large part of the company and our customer base in Europe. So usually there's activity that predates me getting up pretty early on. But the day in particular we're talking about, it's a Tuesday. So our management team weekly meeting starts at 9 o'clock Eastern. We go through very round the horn, kind of metrics in the company, right? All that kind of good stuff on Tuesday. And then from there, honestly, my day will usually be a mix of either one-on-ones and sort of team meetings, so more internally focused, and then external stuff. I love meeting with customers. I love helping our sales team, being in front of folks that way, if I can help that. And then also just more general kind of external activities, things like a podcast recording or a press interview are usually part of the mix. Interviewing candidates is a big part of what I do. It's really important to me to make sure I've got a good pulse on our candidates coming in and making sure we're adding to the Blueconic culture in a really specific way. That usually gets me through kind of a full workday. I tend to leave this space that I'm in right now, my home office, and go downstairs and do a change of scenery to kind of wrap up, make sure I've gotten through emails and all that kind of thing to end the day on a little bit more of a decisive note. And then ideally, right, it's dinner, make some dinner, order in whatever it might be, depending on our energy levels with my husband, and get in bed on a relatively early side of things. I like to try to get up early. So I try to go to bed early. Read, usually not on my phone at that point, or an actual book, and then we rinse and repeat. So that's kind of, you know, a shell of a day in my life, typically speaking.
Okay. So that was a fly by the wire. Thank you for sharing. It's very interesting because I guess I want to know, out of your day, How many emails are you waking up to? What's in your inbox? Are you dealing with a dozen emails, 20 emails on average? Are you someone like Mark Zuckerberg that's dealing with hundreds of emails? You know, he's got a very interesting routine himself when he gets up and starts his day.
Yeah, I think it's a combination. So it's email and Slack, typically, right? So I'm going to have both of those. I would say, you know, anywhere from 15 to 20. If I've done a check before I go to bed, say around 9 o'clock is kind of my last check, unless I know there's something going on. And then if my first check is at 6 o'clock, you know, usually 20-ish emails and Slacks. We're all pretty respectful about the fact that everyone's in different time zones and that kind of thing. Yep. So it doesn't tend to ramp up a lot really until kind of more normal business hours. But it's important to me, and I try to be good about this in terms of balancing always on and immediate responses with making sure I'm having focus time and also not necessarily just responding instantaneously. I'm someone who likes to keep things moving, and that's not always necessarily the right thing. So it's kind of finding a right balance. But I do think one of the important parts of my job and role is to make sure that I'm not a blocker to other people getting their work done. So I tend to have a pretty widespread availability and keep things moving, usually on behalf of other people. I think that's a big thing, that I can help my team with their own efficiency if I'm doing that in the right way, keeping it balanced. I don't always strike that perfectly, but I try.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because like, for me, I'm like very selfish with email. So like, I'll get my inbox out, and if there's emails that make me feel happy, I'll reply to them straight away. But if the ones that like, you know, like for example, like fan mail, right? Like, of course. Like, oh, I love that. It's like, I'll reply that straight away, right? So I feel good about that, you know. But ones that are a little bit more tense, right? Like, for example, my finance person emails me or something, or there's an invoice that's just come through, or, you know, I'm like, okay, I might need to sit on this for a little bit. It's interesting. Like, my psychology is really weird. I'm like really selfish with email and Slack and stuff. It's like, I'll let something sit on red for like 3 days if I'm just like, I don't want to touch it yet. But the thing with starting with email is that, in my view personally, and I'm the worst at this, is that it changes your mentality for the rest of your day, especially if you've got a tense email that it's a bit stressful. So that's why I kind of avoid those ones that might be a little bit more stressful, purely because it changes my outlook on the day quite a bit. I could have one bad email in the morning and then I'm grumpy all day. But how do you address that? Is it like,
no, I mean, I totally hear you.
Yeah. What do you think?
No. It's the same thing, right? And the same is true at the end of the day, right? If I don't unplug and then something comes in late, it can make it hard to sleep and all of that. So I hear you. I think I know there's a lot of best practices on this. What I sort of find is it's a little bit like if a tree falls in the woods and no one's here to hear about it, did it really happen? It's kind of the same thing with bad email. Like, it's going to come through and I'm going to have to face up to it. And so what I do try to do is, you know, before I check or whenever that is, am I prepared for something to kind of be disruptive or stress me out? I got to be honest, my job has a fair amount of stress in it, so I'm pretty well adjusted to that reality, right? I'm pretty prepared for my inbox to not be my friend necessarily. I've made that adjustment. But yeah, like I am really diligent. For example, if I am in a scenario where there's actually nothing I'm going to be able to do if there's an issue, then I'm not checking, right? I don't want to know about it if I can't help. That also extends to like PTO and vacations, right? Just working yourself up. I know everyone deals with this a little bit differently, but I'm on a regular basis pretty well prepared for it. And then that just gives me permission when I can't deal with that stuff, that I'm really carving out the space and people kind of know why. So I don't know that I have a perfect answer, but it's what works for me.
Yeah, it is like so much because, you know, the further up you get up the chain into leadership, almost all the work is managing your feelings and your relationships.
Yeah.
You know? And like, you know, for example, when I started my career, it was all skills-based, right? You know, like learn Google Analytics and, you know, make that work for a client, or, you know, figure out how to set up Shopify, or how to figure out how to set up Salesforce CRM. Like those were the practical things. I was just like, I got to learn how to do that. So I'd spend a lot of time on YouTube just learning the practical skills. But as I've grown in my own work and leadership, I realized, wow, this job is decisions. It's emotions and relationships, and like time is kind of totally irrelevant to that often. You know what I mean? Like, sure, you got to be practical, move on from the next meeting, you know? Like, I've only got 60 minutes with you, which I'm so grateful that you can be with us. But so much of it is, like actually spending that time managing your own mental health and your own space, which can be like, it is interesting. I want to talk about in a minute, like that shift from being a staff member to being on the executive team and leading the business and what that changed for you. And so maybe we park that for now because I want to still dig into your day, Corey. Sorry. I want to get more into your day because I mean, I want to talk about that, like the mentality shift for you and how you sort of worked through that. But before we get there, I want to talk more about your day because you said that, okay, you get up, you work out in the basement, you check your emails. So you check your emails before you work out. Is that right?
I do.
That's really interesting because I find that so I work out in crazy times throughout the week, right? So I'll work out on Monday, I'll work out around 11 a.m. And then on Wednesday, I'll work out at like 7 p.m. And then on Friday, I'll work out at some point during the day, right? And then maybe Saturday. So like I work out three times a day, but it's like 2 hours. But what I find is that mental time working out is actually like, it really, helps me process stuff a lot. So is there like a reason why you would do your workouts after email, or is that just because of schedule? You kind of need to just be updated before you get into your day.
Yeah. I just want to know what I'm getting into with the day. And if there is something stressful to the point we just made, then I still have time to work through that, afterward. It's funny, I had a little bit of a sample size when the pandemic started and I was suddenly working from home all the time. Whereas before I was working from home maybe one day a week. I tried the kind of laissez-faire approach to my schedule where it was like, well, I'll just, you know, today I'll work out at noon or whatever. I'll just be flexible. And when I tell you, I hated that with a fiery passion and it added so much stress to my life. It took me 2 weeks to realize that that's not how this is going to work. And so even though I was home and even though theoretically I had more flexibility, I think I find a lot of the people ask me all the time about sort of work-life balance, right? I find that in routine because I protect certain times of day. I protect certain spaces for myself, and doing that in a routinized way also means that it's easier for me to protect it, which is not the case. You know, I could block, say, I'm going to work out at lunch. And it's like, well, if a customer escalation happens or something pops up, which happens all the time, then of course I'm not going to say, well, sorry, folks, I can't get on the phone to talk about an incident or to help with the sales call. I need to go exercise. Like simply that's, I'm not going to make that choice. And maybe other people would make that. I'm not able to, or don't feel I'm able to. So a lot of it is just more about making sure I get that time in for me. So yeah, it's really not a question of like any specific set of decisions. It's just more, I want to know what the day is going to look like. That's how I get my headspace around. This is what's awaiting me. But in the meantime, I'm going to go exercise, walk the dog, you know, get ready in the interim. It's extremely rare that I wake up to an emergency, right? Thank God, knock on wood, all of that. So it's really just kind of getting my head in the right space and then taking some time, restoring. And then when I sit down at my desk, like I'm really ready to go.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, giving you a moment, because I guess the thing with email is that the format of it is it's sort of like you have to respond right away. You know, you feel like, okay, I'm here reading it. Let's respond now, you know, but taking that moment to reflect on it and to think before you actually start processing and thinking through all the communications for the day, I think that's a good way of thinking about it, right? Because it gives you just a minute of pause to go and reflect and go, what's the right way of doing that? And, you know, the way I think about this is like, you know, this is going to sound crazy, but like, I'm a big fan of like Ludwig Wittgenstein and Bertrand Russell. So they were early philosophers in the 20th century, back in like 1910, 1920, throughout World War One and Two. And Bertrand Russell, he was a mathematics philosopher and professor. And so what he would do with his own thought life, he would say that a lot of us underestimate the power of our subconscious. So even though you're not thinking about something, your mind is still processing information, even though it's not consciously in your mind thinking about it right or interacting with it right in the minute. So he would say that if he's tackling something hard, like some piece of work or some conversation or something he needs to tackle, he would work at it furiously for an hour, maybe 2 hours maximum. And then he would let it sit in his subconscious for like a week or a month. And he would come back and he would have all this clarity about what he needs to do. And so it sounds like in a very shorter, much shorter time scale, on a daily time scale, that's kind of what you're doing, right? You're getting all that information into your subconscious, and then you go work it out as you prepare your day. Then you come back, I'm sure, with a lot more clarity on how to respond to things or how to address situations, or, you know, because being a CEO, there's like so many situations you have to untangle, right? Like, you know, there's so many things you go, oh, if I do this and such and such will react that way. Or, you know, if I set up a meeting, what would that look like to the team? You know, things like that, right? So I find that that's really quite helpful for my own thought life to say, oh, actually, if you kind of outsource your thinking to your subconscious mind while you're doing other stuff, you'll come back and you'll figure out that most problems are solved, or most of the things that you need to figure out have already been figured out.
Yeah. I mean, that's a ton of neuroscience on that, right? And not just from him, but much more recent as well. Focus sprints and all of that. I think there's also just an element of behaviorally, you are, as the executive, the person who can slow things down. And so I think part of it is also me getting used to being on the other side of the table, where I need to take the time to make sure that I'm processing it and thinking about it. Cause like, there probably isn't going to be another check that comes after me on some of the stuff that's more serious. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's as much a deliberate practice, not if I don't have the answer, but hey, here is my answer, but I'm going to sit and make sure that it's the right one. And making sure that people are slowing down in that regard. So a lot of it is very deliberate on my part. And a lot of it is also, sort of the neuroscience of how to make sure you're doing your best thinking and all of that. I think a lot of that is also just true though, like life gets in the way. So, you know, I can try to do my best at some of this stuff, and that doesn't change that 185 people are running, you know, all full speed at the things that I've asked them to work on and the company expects them to do, and customers are doing what they're doing and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, best laid plans of mice and men a little bit. So I control what I can control. And then I kind of just make sure that I'm energized and have my cup filled up for whatever I can.
Yeah, that's great. And do you work remotely most of the time from home, or do you work in the office partly through the week as well?
Yeah, no, for the most part now I'm fully remote. So we had a bigger office in Boston for a long time. And then when the pandemic happened, obviously we had a lot of folks go remote. We also hired a lot there. But I think one of the things that was sort of an embedded strength of ours from the beginning is that when the company first started, our co-founders were Dutch. They moved to the US, but there was half the company still in the Netherlands, and then the other half was here. So even when we were quite small. And so that meant really the entirety of Bluconic's history is that people were remote to one another. Even if we were all in two offices, we were still using Slack and email and Zoom and, you know, whatever our precursors were back then. And so as we grew as a company, pandemic kind of considerations aside, we were really well set up to do things well in a more remote capacity. So we still have a small space downtown. It's kind of, you know, operates as headquarters, of course. But our team, you know, is all over the place. And so I think for me, I spend a lot of time now thinking about kind of the future of work and what does that look like? And that's something I spend a ton of time on. And I don't think that the future of work is people, you know, getting back into one single space on a regular basis, going in and going out. And I think there's a lot, you know, it's just a very dislocated, challenging time. This is really hard to navigate through. There's a lot of competing data. There's a lot of competing feelings. So it's not an easy thing to necessarily navigate. But for us, for now, it's absolutely the right approach. And our team in the Netherlands still is in an office much more frequently. The US is almost entirely distributed at this point. So we make that work and have just, you know, we're going to keep adapting and learning as we get through it, but it's working really well for us, I would say.
Yeah. So it seems like remote working has always been in the character of the business. I mean, over time, it's just become more and more important that post COVID and seeing how everyone going fully remote, and, you know, it is interesting thinking about, like, because that changes your routine quite a bit. You don't have a commute. So a lot of people use their commute for reflection time, getting into their day, you're finishing up.
Totally.
But, you know.
Yeah, I think about that. My new commute is my dog walk. you know, like instead of walking to the train and taking the train, I'm on a dog walk instead. So I'm still, that's where the structure part comes in, is you do need to have those times. They just, you might need to get a little creative about the way that those times show up in your calendar. So.
Okay. So we're almost done with your day because, we've talked in the morning and then we're moving through into, I guess the first half of your day up until lunchtime. So do you take a lot of calls in that first half of the day? Like, do you do a lot of team sessions? I think you mentioned that you looked at financials and you do a bit of a reporting piece in Tuesday mornings. So is that kind of your meeting time? Is that for your internal team?
Yeah, it depends. Again, when you have a lot of folks in different time zones, there's like some precious hours of the day where we're all kind of in a civilized level of overlap.
Yeah,
I'm pretty diligent about my calendar structure. I have an A week and a B week. A weeks are largely one-on-ones dominated and then lots of time for external. B weeks are smaller team meetings. Ooh. So you get the whole of the customer success team or customer leadership team, rather, instead of I have one-on-ones with them in an A week, and then the five of us will meet in the B week.
That's cool.
So that's kind of my structure. Yeah. And then I, of course, leave time for other standing things. I've got board, you know, check-ins. I've got customer meetings. The biggest one for me that I sifted to this year was we already did a no meeting Friday kind of setup, which has worked really well. What I find, though, is that by the time I get to a Friday, this is also neuroscience, right? Like, my brain's pretty tired. And so I wasn't doing a great job of necessarily doing kind of the bigger thinking type of stuff that I needed to be doing. So I block my entire Monday for focus work.
Yep.
And it's Q4 right now. So I admit I've made some exceptions to that because, you know, priorities. But for most of the year, I will keep Monday completely free so that I can be offline, sort of working and thinking at my own pace. And then Friday, even though it's an opening Friday, I just do a lot of external meetings on Fridays. So for me, that works really well. I have great energy in an extroverted sense. So whether it's podcast recordings, press stuff, interviews, right? Those kind of things. Mm. But what I'm really sensitive about is trying to avoid inflicting meetings on internal folks. Like, it's their no meeting Friday and that might work really well for them. So those are kind of the biggest ways I structure my day. But yeah, again, within that, it's really a breakdown of internal types of stuff. I try not to have too many meetings with people, right? They all have jobs to do. But keeping also my schedule free, I think a real mentality shift for me was I would try to block time to work in a given day. Mm. And then when inevitably, again, something happened. Away. I think almost all time management like hacks are meant for people who are like writers and make, you know, have total control over their own schedules. They're never written for people who are either executives or managers and therefore have people who are inherently variable and unpredictable. Mm. And or people who work in customer facing roles. You can't predict when a customer is going to want to get on the phone, right? Or when a sales call needs to happen. And so I used to get really frustrated that I'd block time to get work done and then not get it done and then feel like I failed. So I now actually just deliberately leave a lot of free time, as much free time as I can in my calendar for this stuff that inevitably ends up happening. And that was a real good mindset shift for me of how to manage my time and calendar better. So I didn't feel like I was constantly failing and instead keeping myself open for the stuff that I knew was going to happen. So that's kind of my strategy for time management on a day-to-day, week-to-week basis in a nutshell.
Yeah, that's cool. I think I like, there's a few things I like about that. The first one is A and B weeks, right? So you're having like different formats with the same people. So the different types of conversations, an A week and a B week. You know, I think that's quite great because you get like, because I'm assuming, can you give me a number? How many one-to-ones do you reckon you do in a month with people? Or like how many one-to-ones do you do with people just generally?
Yeah, so I have a rather large direct report organization at the moment. So I have 12 direct reports.
Goodness.
Yeah, which is a lot and that's okay. Wow. But that's why also having one weekly one-on-ones would just kind of get ridiculous. And also not a good use of time. I want people talking to each other with me in the room, not just talking to me one-on-one. So all of my one-on-ones, I try to make them 45 minutes every other week. And then the team meetings are usually an hour or hour and a half every other week. So, you know, it's a good chunk of my time. Yeah. It's a good 20-25% of my time.
Yeah.
I would say in one-on-ones, either those, the recurring one-on-ones or I have plenty of other kind of one-off one-on-ones that happen as well. So that's like a good 25% of my time, I would say.
Yeah. Wow. Isn't it amazing how important one-on-ones are in any organization? Just like by 30 minutes of FaceTime to talk, because that's a full day a week, right?
Yeah.
That's a lot of money.
It's so
right?
important.
You know, that's, yeah. you know, however X many, you know, it's probably, I don't know, $10,000-$15,000 a week just on one-on-ones. Just in terms of like the pure time cost of people, you and those people being a one-on-ones.
I don't really think about meetings as the cost of them. I think about them as investments. And is this a worthwhile investment? I think meetings, I actually pretty rabid about this. Like, I think meetings get a really terrible rap. And I actually loved Raw Signal Group, which is a talent kind of consulting company out of Toronto, who are just amazing. We use them all the time. Jonathan and Melissa Nightingale, their weekly newsletter, they wrote a piece about, like, if you just replaced meetings with collaboration, it would change the whole nature of conversation about them.
Yeah.
So meetings get a really bad rap, but what you're actually talking about is collaboration and information sharing and rapport building, right? All of these things that if I use those, you suddenly would never say, well, how much does it cost for you to build rapport? Like, no one would ever say that, but they do say it about meetings. And so I think, you know, again, this is like about being really thoughtful in how you approach these things. I will give people time back if they don't need it, right? But it's about being prepared. We use tools to make sure we're really prepared. And we adjust as we need to. But I am a meeting enthusiast, like, especially in a remote environment, you need a way of making sure you're having those interactions, getting people the information, and done right, they're a critical tool. Done wrong, they're a drag. But again, I think about it more as, are you collaborating well? Are you building relationships well? Not, are you doing good meetings?
Yeah, that's a really great way of thinking about it, because I agree that that investing in people means investing in relationships and doing one-to-ones. And sometimes those one-to-ones, there's nothing productive happening, you know. I actually think that's great, because what you're doing is that you're creating a method of communication. It just greases the wheels, right? In the, you know, every company as it gets bigger turns into bureaucracy at some point, you know. Like, unfortunately, people fight for resources. There's politics that go on. There's people that you like and you don't like. And that's just the nature of humanity, right? Like, the bigger the organization, the more political, the more bureaucracy happens. It's almost unavoidable, right? But how do you, as best possible, grease the wheels? Well, one advice I got from a long time ago from an old guy who ran a nonprofit for years, helping with student mental health, and, you know, but his advice years ago when I worked under him, he said that whenever you have conflict or you have tense situations, what you want to do is you want to really intensify relationships, because the relationships and the rapport building, as you say, make decisions quicker. They ensure that the better quality work is happening, that people feel that they're trusted, that there is a certain level of mutual agreement on what you believe in and the vision and all those kinds of things. And so I think that, as you say, meetings, a lot of people say meetings are a total waste of time, but in a lot of cases, it's actually a fantastic way to build rapport and a great way to really grease those wheels of relationship. You know, most things break down to businesses, not because of the technology or the data or even the time. It's actually the relationships when things break down, you know. You know, so it is kind of interesting hearing you say that it's a very valuable investment, spending 25% of your time on calls, one-to-one, or in small groups with folks.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, no, I mean, much like anything, it's a management tool. It's a company tool. Some companies will do it differently and some people will do it well. Some people won't. Yep. But yeah, I think it's really important. So I spend a lot of time in meetings. I admit it.
That's great. Okay. All right. I think we've had enough of your day, because it is very interesting thinking how you process stuff. I only had one last question before we move on, which is, do you spend any time in your week tinkering with technology? For example, I'll give you an example. Dharmesh, he's a CTO, co-founder of HubSpot. That dude spends like all of his week, you know, tinkering with tech and building new things. At the moment, he's trying to build an AI agent system, and he's trying to figure out how to use generative AI for certain things and then bring that back into HubSpot. So obviously, that guy's CTO, very technically minded, but he spends a lot of time tinkering in the tech, learning about the technologies. Do you spend a lot of time to, like, thinking about the tech that's out there, or sort of learning about it, getting hands-on, doing demos, stuff like that?
I don't personally. I spend a lot of time on more of the market dynamics and competitive things and what the analysts are saying, and more. I mean, again, I'm a kind of analyst by history and a product marketer by origin story. So that's where I typically spend most of my time versus like hands-on technical aspects of it. Yeah. But yeah, that's just me. I spend a lot more time on the market and that half of the equation. And a play example of like why you have a team around you, right? Everyone's got to be exposing themselves into that. Our VP of product is amazing, super hands-on with that kind of thing. And we talk about it all the time. It's just, I'm not technical by training. So that's not the kind of thing I dive into. But a lot of the positioning and sort of more analyst oriented stuff, I guess I would call it, is where I spend a considerable amount of time for sure.
Yeah, that's great. And you know, it is interesting. It's funny, even in my own work, I have like this craving to like get on tech demos and like learn, because obviously we're a media company, need to be ahead of things, right? But it is like, I find it was a better use of your time, right? Like, you know, for me, like our business is a bit different in that I write 2 days a week. So Monday and Tuesday, it's like, don't even talk to me. I don't even reply to emails, because Monday, Tuesday, I'm just deep writing. I don't want to contaminate my thinking with like external stuff. And then Wednesday, Thursday, Friday is my business development days, which are a combination, like 95% are outward facing meetings with customers and prospects and all kinds of people, podcast guests, stuff like that. But like, it's interesting, like that time tinkering or just like figuring out what's going on in the marketplace is also a really good investment as well, right? Like thinking, okay, well, what are other people doing? You know, because we can become so insulated. That's the challenge with a lot of this, is that you can become so insulated into the internal dynamics around business and not spend enough time actually out there in the marketplace thinking about, you know, how is the industry changing? How's it shifting? Which is perhaps bring me to one more question outside of your day, which is, how do you think about that? Like you said, you spend a bit of time reading the news every day, you know, just to stay ahead of what's going on. But like, how do you think about the focus between spending your time studying the market versus spending time within your business and thinking about the internal situation of Blueconic?
Yeah, I mean, I think about it a lot in terms of trying to make sure I'm doing the right amount of it. I think one of the things that is going to vary CEO to CEO or exec to exec is like what draws their attention, where they think they can add value. I think it's really important for me to know the context that our business is operating in at a couple different levels, right? Like what's going on in the world? What are the big trends in business writ large? Then what are the trends happening in software specifically? What are the trends happening in private equity and private equity backed software? Because that's where I am. What's happening for our customers, right? All of those pieces are part of a puzzle that I think the better I have a grip on generally makes me more effective also at recognizing patterns than when I look to the business, right? What are we not thinking about? What should we be thinking about? So I bring that lens to bear. I also think, right, this is where spending time with customers and prospects and making sure that you know the language that they're using to describe problems, right? All of that is really critical inputs. So I would describe myself as someone who brings a lot of, likes a lot of inputs from a lot of different places. I'm not just like one set of things, nor am I just, you know, reading business books. I think you can learn a lot and be a better person and leader because you read things that have nothing to do with the stuff that you do every day, right? And then, you know, again, I think it's about a little bit, I guess, being agile, right? Sometimes I need to have shorter one-on-ones, or I need to say, hey, look, I can only meet for 15 minutes. Let's hit on the really important stuff because I'm traveling. Right. I mean, that's the reality, but I think, you know, you get yourself, this is where I come back to the routine. You know, it's like anything, you build certain muscle, you get into certain behaviors that people can count on. And then it also allows you to deviate from them when you need to, right? You're not erratic. People know that they can count on you. This is not just you canceling my one-on-one for the 50th time. It's like, hey, you know what, guys, I got to get to New York because I have a meeting tomorrow. Sorry, you know, let's reschedule, right? Like, so I think I'm just not being someone and knowing what you can set expectations up is part of how I manage, again, structurally. But it's also true of the information and how I spend my time on learning about the business. Sometimes I need to spend a ton of time on what's going on externally. During annual planning, I'm spending a lot more time on what's going on internally. So it's really more of a pendulum a little bit, I guess, than anything else. I don't think I have a good, you know, hard and fast 50-50 or something. I think you're 20% minimum on either end. And then what happens in the middle is just depending on what's going on in the business, which again, the business changes week to week, month to month. I got a plan. I got a plan to be unplanned. That's really what I best serves me.
That's interesting. Yeah.
What I can do.
Yeah. Because it's such a temptation as a CEO to have no serendipity, you know, like no, if like flexible time where like I call it, you know, the way I think about it is like there's beer mode and there's coffee mode. The current stole this idea from David Perel. He does a lot of work around writing and thinking about writing, but he says, you know, in beer mode, it's like lateral thinking. It's like ideas and exploring and, you know, thinking about, you know, all the opportunities. In that time, it's kind of like you're at a university campus, right? You want to just bump into people and chat, you know. So when I would, for example, like one day a week, I'd go into the city and sometimes I'd meet with folks and I'd go back to their offices and just hang out and chat, you know, and I'd call that serendipitous, you know, beer time, right? Where you're just like hanging out, but you know that it doesn't feel productive because you're not like getting stuff done, but you know that it's really helpful for your thought life. But then you move into coffee mode where, as you say, oh, I've got to be in New York by 9 a.m. You know, oh, we've got this thing that needs to be done, right? And it's like you're smashing down coffees really so that you can get some type of output done, right? And it's not serendipitous. It's very focused. Every conversation is focused. Every time, every bit of time is focused. And so like vacillating between those two things, like going between coffee mode and beer mode, I found really helpful, not purely just so I don't feel guilty when I'm spending time just chatting with people, you know.
Yeah,
I find that like, because we are our own worst critics with most of the time. I find that like we as you say earlier, right, like it's, oh, you know, you don't want to feel like you're a failing every day because you're not getting that 2 or 3 hour block of focus time, you know, like we are so critical in ourselves, we just compound into more negativity, which compounds into less productivity, which means that you're less available for people and, you know, you become more and more stressed. But if you take that away and say, oh, actually, I'm just in a situation right now where I'm actually just happy to chat, you know, and just like build relationships with people and think about ideas. Maybe we get into a workshop and we whiteboard some stuff and think, you know, brainstorm, you know, no strings attached, right? Like all of that, people think it's waste, but I think it's necessary waste because it helps with your thought life and also helps you keep connected to why you really enjoy the work. Which I guess talking a bit about the work, I mean, we've talked a little bit about your day and we're talking about, you know, how you split your time between the industry in and out. But I want to understand, I guess you kind of transitioned into the CEO role fairly recently. I'd love to get a view from you, like what's one main thing, mental shift that you've had to make between being a staff member to being the leader of Blueconic?
Yeah. You know, I use this analogy, I think, to describe it, which is that especially having started the company, I was employee 17, right? I was the first, one of the first American hires. I was the first and only woman for a long time. I've really been through a lot of the different stages of the company over that period. So when I stepped into the CEO role in January, I'd been at the company for 8 years, right? We'd gone from 17 people to 170 right around then, and continued to grow this year. That the way I would describe it is, it was like going from being an architect who lives in a community that they built, where you're walking the streets and you're pointing out, you know, this house used to look like that, and now it's, you know, 10 stories higher, and, you know, this is a development lot, right? All of these sort of things where you're very much at ground level and intimately familiar with kind of all of the nuances of it. And then you become CEO and it's like you're in an airplane above that community and you're looking down on it with still an incredible level of intimacy and familiarity, but your perspective on it has changed structurally. And in fact, you can't really ever walk the streets in the same way, right? I know that me being in a room, virtual or physical, changes the nature of that room. Sometimes for better, but it can also be for worse, right? No one wants an unexpected Slack from me. All of those kind of things that I think just kind of come with the territory. But also from my perspective, you've got to let go of a lot of that stuff too, right? You now have a level of perspective that helps you, in theory, help other people more and say, hey, you know, up from here, I can see around a corner that you can't see around from the ground. Let me make sure that you have that information. Or, hey, from up here, I can actually see that someone is working on this awesome new thing over in this corner, but you can't see that. Let me make sure that you two are connecting. So there's an enormous amount of impact and power still in that. But it is really disorienting to have gone from being someone on the ground who was, you know, I was a little bit higher up. I was the president of the company, right? It wasn't like I was totally going from individual contributor to this. But it was shocking to me quite how dramatic that perspective change was and how quickly it happened.
So how long did it take for you to normalize into that?
I'm not sure I have yet. I think I'm still working on it. You know, it'll be a year, January 5th. Yeah, I mean, I'm still learning. And I've talked to a lot of other CEOs, particularly, right? I'm very lucky by virtue of being part of the Vista portfolio. Mm. I know a lot of the other CEOs in our portfolio and in the other funds. And pretty much all of them say that it takes, you know, 12 to 18 months really to acclimate. And if you couple in what the last year has been like for anybody in a CEO seat in a tech company, where it's been harder than it was before, just to put it mildly, you know, that's a lot to get to adjust to. So I would definitely say I'm more adjusted, of course, now, and it gets better and better. But I'm not sure I would say I'm like fully made the transition all the time, more often than not, but there's still moments, I would say.
Yeah. And I want to ask, I guess, so January 5th, so you had, Thanksgiving and then you had Christmas, and I'm assuming that you would have been having conversations and there would have been a transition period and, you know, there would have been an offer at some point and then, you know, you accepted that offer. Right? I'm just assuming how it usually
more goes. Or less.
Yeah. So what was your decision making around actually taking that role? And the reason I ask is that most people don't want a CEO role because it's very high agency and there's a lot of accountability. You're really like, it's you versus the market in a lot of ways, right? Like you don't have a manager. I'm sure you have mentors and people that support you, but it's kind of the performance of the business is your outcome and the performance of your staff, the well-being of your staff. You're really holding a lot of the levers to control a business as a CEO. And that's super high agency, right? Like most people do not want to have that level of responsibility ever, you know, but what when I went to the decision-making there around, okay, there's an offer here in front of you and go, all right, I'm going to take it. What was going into that?
Well, I don't actually, I mean, it wasn't really as clean as that in the sense that I was the, you know, chosen successor of our founder and CEO. So it wasn't like, you know, I applied for the job and they gave me an offer. It was more of a discussion and then, you know, a nominating process almost for my predecessor with the board and getting the board, making sure that they were supportive of me moving in and him moving out and all of that. You know, I think a byproduct of maybe the way that this happened is obviously there was a moment I chose it. That's for sure. But it was more of a journey to that outcome than it was a decision, I guess. And I think I say it that way because in a lot of ways, and I still very much feel this in the role now, like I'm a byproduct of Blueconic. Like I never set out for this. I never imagined in a million years that when I started here on January 12th of 2015, that, you know, exactly 8 years later, I would be stepping into the CEO role. Like literally that thought never, ever crossed my mind then. Mm-hmm. And so for me, I think about this it's an honor. Like, I don't have really any other word for it. And so I guess that's how I think about it. It's like, it was never it wasn't so much a decision as it was a huge transference of responsibility and honor from the person who I'd worked so closely with for the 8 years prior. And it's no small thing to take over a CEO from a founder. Like when they choose you, right? It wasn't like he was being forced out or something. He was ready and said, you know, this is the person who needs to lead Blueconic into this next chapter. Mm. That's that's not a decision. I don't know how to characterize it accurately, but I think of it less as a decision than anything else. And so I don't know, that has really informed, I guess, how I think about it. It's not a job that I took. It's kind of a gift on which I was, which I guess is maybe not the way most people talk about their jobs or their professions, but for me, that is what it really is. And I take it super seriously, more for that reason than anything else.
Yeah. Cause again, it's, you know, for the folks that do want it, they do want that level of accountability. And I understand that you've been on a long path of growing the business and really that Blue Conics in your blood, right? Like you know the business inside out, but also you've been in like leadership positions that have a lot of that accountability as well, right? So it's not like a shock to the system, you know, same business, very similar people, different perspective, as you say. But I can imagine, like, when you got that offer and it was finalized, how, you know, like, I would have felt amazing about that, right? But I'm a bit, my story is a bit different. I felt like I called my, when I got my first ever, well, my senior appointment in my last company, right? I was like, okay. I called my wife, you know, I was like, oh, you know, I got this and it's amazing. And the pay, the salary is much better, you know, all of those things. But there is a real sense of, wow, you actually like, achieved this. I got this to this level professionally. Did you have that experience, or was it just like, this is the next day in the office, you know?
It's hard to even put it into words. It was of course. Maybe I should give some context. Very infrequently tell people I'm a CEO.
Really?
In fact, I go out of my way to avoid it. I think, obviously in a professional sense, like it's relevant. It is a job that, to your point about not a lot of people want it, but also therefore not a lot of people understand it. And so it is, and it's a job that connotes kind of all what you're talking about, a certain level of achievement. And I don't know, like makes people feel like they need to be impressed by me. And I hate that. Yes. I don't think that at all. I think that I am one of 185 people who share responsibility. Yes, I have an outsized portion of that and more control. And I'm not like, you know, implying that it's all equal, but I don't approach this job as like my crowning achievement. It is my biggest responsibility and my biggest opportunity. And I'm very lucky to be in that. So for me, it's not so much about, and I agree with you. What's funny, kind of maybe going to the question of like how it's different. All of my previous promotions did feel like that. They felt like this sort of, yes, like that's awesome. Like I'm feeling recognized and I'm feeling rewarded. And like all of those promotions felt exactly as you're describing. This one didn't feel that way to me. It just didn't. And I think, again, it comes with the nature of the role for me that it's much more of a responsibility than a promotion per se. And I think there's a lot of goodness to that, quite frankly. I think it keeps my feet on the ground. I think there's a lot of people who like being CEOs because they like to tell people that they're CEOs and it doesn't necessarily make them very good at it. Maybe it doesn't, but I'm not in it to be able to tell people I am one. And in fact, again, I work harder at asking. I tell my good friends if I'm meeting their friends or meeting strangers, I'd prefer if we could not talk about it. I talk about what I do for work. I talk about the people I work with. I talk about our customers. I talk about everything that's going on around me that gives me so much energy and is so awesome. But I don't really talk about me and my job, my title very often.
Yeah, it's so interesting hearing you talk about that because I've been through a kind of a similar experience in that, you know, I've transitioned from being an employee to a founder, an entrepreneur, a company, business owner, you know, CEO. Yeah. So I've got a team. But I kind of think about it in the sense of that, like, yeah, it's similar. Like when I had promotions, I used to care a lot about those promotions and like I really want them and go after them and then feel so accomplished that I got to that level, you know. But with this, it's so different. It's almost as though like the greatest among you must be the least, or like the person that's the greatest must be the servant, right? And that's kind of my mentality. It's like I'm trying to serve customers, you know, as best as possible. And I'm trying to serve my team. And I had a conversation the other day with, we just hired a research assistant and he's come on part time. But I said, mate, my job is to get you full time and it's successful, right? My job is to serve you, you know, yeah. Like not to lord over this power or to say how magnificent or glorious that I am. It's actually, my job is like, actually, it's pretty humbling. It's like, you're just here to serve a company the best way you can, you know? Yeah, and it's
exactly.
And it is like, and I hear what you're saying about folks that really want that title and they want that prestige or that status that goes along with the role. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't tend to go well when people want it that badly. It's almost as though, you know, you kind of have, it's like a total mentality shift. It's like, yeah, you're totally responsible for these people. In the same way that I serve my, I've got a 5 and a 3-year-old, got children, the same way in my family that I want to serve them and want the best for them and help them grow and be and thrive as people. Same way with the company. It's like, I want these people to grow and I want really healthy relationships and I really just want to serve them and help them grow, right? It's not this thing where you kind of get this amazing trophy and go, oh, how great am I? It's actually the total mentality shift to just service. And a lot of that's just like hard work and, you know, being just, I guess, being very, very cognizant of other people's needs. 100%. Putting others before yourself. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, look, my highest, best, like if I know I'm doing well, the less other people need me. Right. That means that I am giving them the information. I'm giving them the context they have. I'm hiring really well. Mm. So the more that Blueconic as an entity thrives without me shows that I am doing a better and better job. Right. And of course that changes. We have setbacks because the company changes and it's a sliding scale. But I think a lot about what did I do this week that made it better, easier for other people to help this company thrive. Yeah. It's ultimately not going to be a story about me at all.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like they're lucky to have you. That's for sure.
I don't know about that, but you know, we're not going to invite them on. You can have that as a separate podcast and keep bringing the popcorn to that one.
Which I guess gets me to one of our second to last questions here is about managing complexity. Marketing technology businesses, particularly companies that have funding such as Blueconic and history of funding and as you say, equity, part of a portfolio businesses, you've got a lot of stakeholders to manage, right? You've got customers, you've got the board, you've got investors, you've got your own executive team, you've got 12 direct reports. There is amazing amount of complexity, particularly because of the technology is very complex as well most of the time.
Totally.
And so what is one thing you do to help balance that out, to manage through that complexity? Is there a framework that you use, or is there a way of approaching problems or situations that you try to employ to simplify that complexity?
Maybe I'm a masochist. I love how complicated it is, right? I think I thrive in the complexity because to me, the way I think about my own kind of professional career development is I want to keep growing and I want to keep learning. And so complexity is an opportunity to learn always. And so that is how I feel about it. Like it's not, you know, you don't want complexity for complexity's sake, but I thoroughly enjoy figuring out how to solve the problem, preferably with other people. So I think what I'm good at is I am the first to tell you if I don't know something, and I'm really comfortable going to ask for people who are smarter than me, or I think have better information to explain it, to give me the context. And then I think I'm good at synthesizing information. Maybe it's the analyst, you know, the analyst in me, or I found an analyst job or whatever. But I, you know, I was a political science major in college. Again, I had no anticipation of working for a tech company one day, but like, I love getting super deep into lots of information and then seeing what patterns emerge to me and thinking about them. And then, you know, really critically translating them into ways that other people can use, right? It's like not enough for me to have this beautiful mind thing going on if nobody else understands what's happening. So like what inputs am I getting and where am I seeing patterns? Where am I seeing that pulled together and how do I articulate it in a way that is consumable and helpful to the people around me? That's often easier said than done. But for me, it's something I really enjoy. And I think part of why I do enjoy this role in and of itself is I like having the full picture. I don't like feeling as if I'm missing something or that like there's part of a puzzle that I don't have access to. So in that sense, this role is well suited to me, or I'm well suited to it, because I kind of like the complexity. And I think uniquely I'm not a founder, obviously. We've talked about that. But I did come in early, and my background was in marketing tech from the analyst side of things. So I have kind of a quasi both operator and subject matter expertise halves of me, right? So in that regard, I've learned to operate a business, but I came in knowing MarTech and sort of saying, so for me, like, it's two halves of the same coin. I think what makes me a good operator is largely related to how knowledgeable I continue to be about the space. But also, I don't lose sight of like, okay, then how do we serve that space as best we can? So that complexity for me is really quite frankly kind of enjoyable, for better or for worse.
So are you the kind of leader that would try to get consensus over the decisions you make in the business? Or are you the kind of leader to say, nope, this is the direction, everyone get on board? Where do you sort of sit on that scale? Alignment focused or direction for, or like just being very clear and direct on a decision that you need to make?
It really depends, honestly. Yeah. Like I think anyone who can say decisively that they're like 100% in either one of those camps is probably missing something. And the other thing I'd say about it is that I think actually those are halves of a process, right? So you can say, this is the first step of a decision, and then get alignment on sort of the reaction to that decision, take it back and say, okay, I synthesized all of it. Here's, you know, phase two decision, synthesize that and get to a different place. And so I think the best decisions are going to be ones that are generally a byproduct of an iterative process. Yeah. Of course, there are times where I come in and say, like, this is what we're doing. But what I hope I am as good at as I try to be is explaining the why behind it. Yeah. And so even if it is a decision that it is well-reasoned, that is data-driven, that it's thoughtful, that I've gotten input from other people, or even if it was like thrust upon me, I can still say, you know, I know this is frustrating, or, you know, maybe comes as a surprise to everybody, but here's a situation. Here's what we're going to do about it. Obviously, if anyone has any, you know, concerns, let's talk about it. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the decision is going to change. So I think it's more in managing that process than it is about being someone who is prone to making a decision kind of one way or the other. And of course, again, the role necessitates you making decisions sometimes with or without context. But I think about it a little bit differently, less of a binary and more of a things that can kind of benefit one another.
Yeah, it isn't like I've been thinking about this a lot because I've worked under leaders that have like a focus on either one. Like one, like it's like you hate him or you hate her, and they're like, this is the decision, right? This is the thing. This is what direction you go in. All right. If you don't like it, too bad, you know? And then I've worked with folks that like really take a long time to make a decision because they need to get everyone aligned and everyone on board and very happy. Right. And of course I'm talking about the extremes here. And as you say, it is complicated. There are within a process, you can use both. I agree. But it is interesting depending on which organization you work for. For me, increasingly, I found that style of leadership that needed to get everyone to agree, and it would take a long time to get everyone on board and to achieve consensus, kind of kills momentum very quickly, you know, and I just didn't like that, you know, as a leader. So for example, right, so we're launching a new product. So we're here towards the end of November, but early December, we're actually launching a new product, probably our most ambitious product yet with the MarTech Weekly. And I remember this about 6 weeks ago, I was sort of figuring out the approach to it. And I was talking to people, and my head of operations, she was like, when are you going to make a decision? You know, we need direction. We need the vision here. We need to figure out what we're doing. And I said, oh, I'm still trying to like collect all the information. Like, as you say, you know, like you kind of, I'm in the beer mode where I'm like just getting insight and, you know, perspective on where we should go. And then it all came to me, and I sat down on a Sunday morning and then wrote the actual presentation of what we should be doing, put together a rough structure of a plan. And then I gave it to an operations person, and then she was like, oh, what a relief. Finally, I have direction, you know? And it was a really interesting process because I thought about it and I was like, yeah, there is something in the process of making decisions where you need to just get the perspective first. You really need that perspective before you launch into something too quickly, you know? But if you wait too long and you're waiting for perspective from everyone, then it can also kill the idea, or it can kill the thing that you need to make a decision on, you know? Like the energy and the emotions around that are very fragile, you know, as, and then they get more and more fragile as you go down the path. You know, that's why a lot of people and say, for example, they're wanting to buy software or they want to buy technology. It's a reason why a lot of people just come back with no decision. It's because they just kicked the can down the road for way too long. And so that's kind of been my thought process at the moment, is like, well, there is a bit of both in it. But in my view, I kind of trend towards trying to make decisions faster, because then you have the added benefit of momentum and that energy behind it that's still there.
Yeah, I mean, there's different ways and different team constructs. There's a lot of variation to everything. I think the best you can ultimately do is try to do your best, try to explain why it's taking longer. And deal with the situations as they kind of present themselves. You know, you're not going to make everybody happy. You got to get comfortable with that for sure.
Yeah. And you know what? That's probably the most interesting part of the job as well, right? When people are totally unhappy and they're happy to say that, they're actually willing to say that they're unhappy or uncomfortable or for whatever reason, you know, that's where the interesting stuff happens, right? Because that's when you get people at their most honest. When you got the cheerleading squad and you're like, they're always like, oh, this is great, you're doing such a great job. You know, that's great, but you don't get any insight. You know, you don't actually get any tangible stuff to help you as a leader, you know? Yeah. Makes you feel good, but it doesn't make you actually a better leader or a better manager of a company. So it is interesting. But I do have, Corey, I do have one last question for you, which is, you know, we've talked at length about your leadership style, the way you think about that CEO role. But I want to talk just a little bit about Blueconic as a business, as customer data platform. You guys have been around for a long time, really at the early days of the CDP category. And you guys have grown, and you know, as that category has grown. But I want to kind of get a view from you, like, what is Blueconic working on? What are you optimistic about in 2024 as we head into next year?
I mean, tons to be optimistic about. The fact of the matter is that the category as a entity, right, exists to solve really critical problems. And we are, you know, as of recording, a couple of weeks out from Google, you know, making a really significant shift away from actually doing, you know, making the meaningful moves on cookies. Yeah. First party data is a critical antidote to that shift. And CDP is right in the square of giving marketers that asset and means to build that asset. Privacy regulations only continue to grow and splinter and be harder to maintain, so that you can get consented data and you can act in an ethical way as a marketer. Also critical from what we do. So I think there's a ton of tailwinds that are only just picking up that give me a lot of optimism. Nice. About kind of what happens next and where we go from here. You know, it's a competitive category. It's a noisy category, but that is only because it's a critical problem that we're trying to solve and help brands accomplish. And so continuing to work with our customers on that, we've got, you know, just amazing partnership with so many of our customers. And that is, that's what gets me going every day along with the Blue Crew. So I have a lot to be very thankful for as we record here on Thanksgiving Eve in the US, but also a lot to be optimistic about going into the new year for sure.
Yeah, and that's fantastic. I mean, we are, I think we're coming back. I think MarTech's coming back. You know, spending is up, you know, the forecast for next year in terms of digital ad spend, in terms of investment in MarTech. It looks like we're on the rebound after what has been, let's face it, a hard 2 years, right? You know, for capital's sure. Dried up. You know, people have been more reticent to invest in MarTech off the back of COVID. But I feel like we're coming back. I've got that same sense of optimism that the industry is actually rebounding from, what's been a pretty challenging 2 years. And, you know, of course, you know, you stepping into the CEO role this year and managing those challenges, and, you know, it's probably one of the best places to be, right? Because then in the times where, you know, there is a lot of more abundance, that you can actually capture that, because you have that, that sort of boot camp, I guess, in terms of being working.
Let's hope.
Let's hope
all the muscle that's been built is serving, gonna continue to serve me well. Absolutely.
Yeah. And so my last question is where we can find you online, but I want to just finish with a story of how we met online because, and I obviously owe you a thank you because you're a customer of TMW, of our subscription, you know,
you bet.
And you emailed me out of the blue, and I kind of looked at it and I didn't know who you were. I was like, oh, just awesome. Subscribers reached out and had really some insightful stuff around how the industry is growing and changing. And, you know, we had an email dialogue, but it took like two or three emails for me to realize, oh, you're the CEO of Blueconic. Okay. Like, it actually took me a while because I just like, oh, this is great. And, you know, obviously a customer that knows what they're talking about. But, you know, that initial email exchange reaching out led to, you know, this podcast. And of course, you know, it's just been brilliant hearing your perspective and like obviously chatting throughout the year as well. So thank you for that, Corey. It's been a huge encouragement for us, but also, you know, just to intellectually engage with folks on where this industry is going. But I want to throw it back to you. I mean, where can people have a dialogue with you? Is there a certain space where you're active online where people can have a conversation or talk more about what it's like being a CEO? I'm sure there's a lot of folks listening in that are looking at leadership and thinking about it and may want some advice or some thoughts from yourself.
Yeah. So I am pretty much evaporated from social media, but I am very active on LinkedIn. But I have abandoned all other platforms for various reasons that someone can ask me about separately if they want to. Okay. But you can definitely find me on LinkedIn for sure. And that is the best place to get at me there.
Awesome. Well, you can definitely find Corey's LinkedIn handle in our show notes if you want to check her out. You can also check out Blueconic, a fantastic CDP platform that's doing some amazing work. It has been one of the mainstays in the space for quite a while now. But that concludes our episode of Making Sense of MarTech. We regularly interview folks just like Corey who are embracing challenges at the forefront of the industry, building amazing technologies and also serving customers in great ways. And so if you want to delve more into the topics that are similar to our conversation with Corey today, you can subscribe at themartechweekly.com. We'd love to see you there. If you enjoyed this podcast, we'd love for you to hit the follow bell and also give us a review as well. We'd love for you to do that. But until next time, thank you, Corey, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.